American author Ann Patchett has written 8 novels, including Bel Canto and The Dutch House, and now her 4th non-fiction volume, a collection of essays called These Precious Days. It coincides, the publication of it, with the 10th anniversary of the opening of the bookstore in Nashville that she co-owns, Parnassus. The essays are generally eulogies to people Ann Patchett loved and loves. They are legion. And she's with me now. Hello.
Hello.
Given the number of people that you love, I imagine that it was quite a big party for Parnassus.
It was a big party for Parnassus. And in fact, I have been working all morning over at the shop. This is the day after Thanksgiving over here in the States, which we call Black Friday, which is a huge shopping day.
I know. Thank you very much. We've inherited that.
Oh, I'm so sorry. Uh-huh. I'm so sorry. So
who invented that, Anne? Yeah. How did Black Friday come about as a big shopping day? Why call it black?
I have no idea. I was raised Catholic, so I always thought of it as some sort of a play on Good Friday. But I don't know. But it is when, you know, your washer and dryer can be purchased for 20% less than usual.
Yeah, or you're televisions. Lucky. I mean, the supply chain things mean we get a kind of measly 5% break yesterday, I think.
Let's
not spend our time commiserating about the price of washing machines. the party. Tell me about the party.
You know, it's funny because we're still trying to be responsible in the pandemic, and we really aren't having parties. We're just having little events so that the store doesn't get overcrowded and we don't lose our social distancing. So I did a little book about the shop dogs, and we had a beautiful poster and some things made up, and that's really what we're doing to celebrate.
I have information. Somebody tells me that Black Friday is technically the day from which retailers in the United States start to turn a profit for the year.
Well, that makes sense.
Yes.
Because I know in the book business, apparently, but somewhere between a third and a fourth of all the money booksellers make in the year is made between Thanksgiving and Christmas. So, yeah, that's when we go into the black, I guess.
So how's it looking for you in the bookstore?
It's looking really good, really good, because people turn to books. And even though we were closed from March until October last year, nobody was in the store. I mean, we were in the store working. And people bought books from us online. People came to the front of the store and we would run out and throw the books into their trunk of their car and they would drive away. And yet we did fine because the customers were so kind and so loyal. I was afraid that everybody would turn to Amazon, but they really didn't. They just showed up in droves to keep us alive.
You've got a couple of, while we're talking about shopping and buying, there are a couple of essays in this book about downsizing, essentially. A year of buying nothing, roughly speaking,
yes.
How to practice a sort of pandemic house clearance. Do you feel relieved when you went through that kind of decluttering business?
Very much so. My husband and I had been talking about moving down the street. There was a pretty house that was for sale about a block away from us. And we looked at it. And when we started talking, what we realized is the only reason that we were interested in moving was that it would force us to go through all of our stuff. And we're not hoarders. We're really pretty neat. But we've lived in this house for a long time. So we decided to just pretend like we were moving and go through everything. And the nice thing is, you know, if somebody walked in right now and said, I need a green pencil, I would be able to put my hand on a green pencil in 20 seconds because I know where every single thing in the house is right now. That's beautiful.
That is a beautiful thing. Will it stay? Will it stay thus?
I think it will stay thus. I am a neat person. I used to smoke, and when I quit smoking, I started cleaning. Smoking was really lovely for a lot of reasons, but if I was writing and I wanted to just take a little break, but not get too far away from work, I would smoke a cigarette. Now I will get up and clean a bathroom, or I'll get up and vacuum one room because I need some sort of like small mindless activity that won't take me away from work, but gives me a little something to do. So, yeah, since I quit smoking, things have been quite neat.
Quite tidy, I imagine. That's called displacement activity.
Yes, it is.
There's a very lovely essay, the title story, of your book, which is about your friend Suki. And
Yes.
it is obvious that you had a more intense time in COVID lockdown than many as a consequence. Suki was the assistant to Tom Hanks. Tom Hanks did your book reading of The Dutch House. And you got to know her as she went into treatment for pancreatic cancer. Can you tell me a little about that? Because it's a hugely illuminating essay.
Yes. So I met Sookie when I was interviewing Tom for his collection of short stories. We really liked each other. We just met for a few minutes. We stayed in touch, maybe an email a month. And in that time of 2 years, she had pancreatic cancer, had surgery, had chemo, got better, had a reoccurrence. And then needed to find a clinical trial for recurrent pancreatic cancer. It's very hard to find a trial that is an exact match for your cancer and is also accepting people. And my husband is a doctor, and he found her a spot here in Nashville. And she was going to come out for about 10 days and then go back to Los Angeles because a hospital near her was opening up the same trial. She came out here. I mean, I had met her once 2 years before for 5 minutes. And she, when I picked her up at the airport, I thought, I don't even really remember what she looked like. She came here, and in those 10 days, COVID happened. And not only were the flights canceled, but the clinical trial back in Los Angeles that was supposed to start up was canceled. So she couldn't travel. And even if she could have traveled, she couldn't have gone home. And my husband started practicing telemedicine out of the dining room. I was on book tour, but I stopped because I obviously couldn't go anywhere. So I was upstairs. Carl was in the dining room. Sookie was downstairs painting. And there we were, locked down together. And we just had a miraculous time because we knew both from the pandemic, but also from recurrent pancreatic cancer, that nothing lasts, and to make the most of the time that we had. And we felt very aware of every moment and very appreciative.
She loved living with you. She loved you and Carl. And in a way, you gave her a new life. I'm not saying she wanted a new life, but she discovered new things in her life with you, brief as it was. And in a way, the pain of losing that for her was greater. The pain of losing her life was greater. That's what I got in part from that essay.
Sookie had always wanted to be a painter. She always thought that that's what she would ultimately do with her life. She was 65. She had a huge job. She worked all the time working for Tom. They went around the world. She had a family. She had a lot of friends. Like everyone has big, busy lives. But suddenly she was stuck here. She had this time. Every day was free, except for the days she went to chemo once a week. And she didn't want to waste a minute of it. And also, I think because I was upstairs writing, she really saw this as the place to make art. And I just knew her as an artist. When we emailed, we always emailed about painting, about art. And I think that it was the fact that I saw her as an artist. All we talked about was art. We didn't talk about the past. We didn't talk about the future. It was a very present tense life of cooking and yoga and art and friendship and being together. And I think that, I mean, I know she really loved it because she was the person that she had always imagined that someday she would be if she had enough time.
It sounds like I'm a glass half full sort of a person, but I can't help thinking that having fallen in love with this new life, the prospect of death must have been all the more terrible for her.
I think yes and no, equally at the same time. Yes, because she saw how great she was, and people responded so overwhelmingly to her art. It was beautiful. She painted the painting on the cover of the book. But at the same time, she knew that she had gotten a chance and that she had taken it, that she got a chance to be that person. Just before she died, she had a huge art show in Los Angeles. It was amazing. It was 10 days before she died. And she got to go to the show. And I said to her, this is your wedding and your funeral and your art opening all together. But everyone was there, and there were her beautiful paintings. She got to do that. And the question is, if she had just lived in her life and never been sick and kept working and running and being so busy, would she ever have made that art?
No, blimey, that's a kind of every cloud has a silver lining story, if ever there was one.
Yes.
That's your dog, Sparks, that she's painted on the cover of your book.
Yes, who is asleep on my feet right this moment.
Nice. Handy to have a dog that sleeps on your feet.
It is, because they're quite cold.
Your husband, Carl, this is cod psychology, right? But in an essay called Three Fathers, you describe your biological father and you describe your stepfather and you describe your mother's third husband, all of whom gave various things to you in their various ways. The stepfather, your mother's second husband, was basically crazy. I mean, you don't beat around the bush. He was a medical professional who flew helicopters, rode motorcycles. So far, so very much like your own husband, Carl.
Yeah, that's really uncomfortable. Although you couldn't find two people who were less similar than Mike and Carl, and they knew each other. And I really have pretty much never known anybody that Carl didn't like, but he just couldn't stand my stepfather, who he knew 20 years before he ever met me. The reason that I met Carl was that my mother was his office nurse. So I married my mother's boss, and we dated for 11 years before we married, because I always thought, well, sooner or later, we're bound to break up. You know, this isn't my type. This isn't the life. And yet we never did break up. And I loved him so much that I finally broke down and married him. But yeah, the whole thing about I married a doctor who flew planes and rode motorcycles, that it's not good. It's not good.
His passion for planes features in an essay called Flight Plan. He kept giving up and then starting again. And at the age of 71, at your behest, because he realized he needed it, he bought another expensive and very reliable plane, despite the fact that you will stay up all night worrying about him if he's out there. That's love.
I really do think that that is an essay about what it means to be married, or what it just means to be in a serious relationship with someone. You can't take out the pieces that you don't like and expect that you will wind up with the same person. I always say Carl is a tapestry, and I don't get to pick out a thread or two that I don't like, because then the whole thing falls apart. And what I love about Carl, that he's brave. He's somebody who can figure things out just on the spot. He's so fast. He loves adventure. He's not afraid of anything. Those are all of the things that make him a great pilot. And so if I worry about him when he flies, then I don't get to change him. I don't get to say, be a brave and adventuresome soul, but just do it in our living room. I have to sort of accept the whole package of him. And the weird part is, I am never, ever afraid when we are flying together. I'm only afraid when he's flying without me, which I think is very weird.
It is weird. How do we explain that?
Because if something happens and we're together, then we're together, right?
Oh,
then we
Lord.
Go together.
All right.
We went on a trip 2 weeks ago, and he was taking me around to a couple of bookstores in Alabama and Mississippi to sign books. And we were coming in to this town, and the fog was horrible. And he has his instrument rating, so he's allowed to fly in the fog. And the terrain was very, very flat. And the fog was just pea soup. And so we're coming in to land, and the voice of the plane, like the plane has a voice. And the plane starts saying in a very loud voice, caution, terrain, caution, terrain.
No.
And I look out the window, and suddenly we come through the fog, and I think, mother of God, those are trees. we're just going into the trees. Pull up. And Carl pulls up. And so we land, and I said, so I've never heard that caution terrain warning. And he said, oh, it was fine. It wasn't a problem. He said the ceiling was very low, and, you know, it didn't make any difference. We weren't in any danger. And I said, truly? I mean, caution terrain, and there are the trees right there, and we're going into the trees. He said, no, that's only a problem when there's a mountain. He said, if it's flat, you know, you can really go right up to the trees and then pull up and you're fine. It's only a problem when you go down and then you pull up and then you fly into the side of a mountain.
Good Lord.
I thought, okay, all right, there you go.
I don't mean to go on about Carl, but you do give him very good PR in this book. And I want you to tell the story of when you were in a passenger aircraft and he tried to buy a baby.
It is my very favorite story about Carl. And I have to say that vignette doesn't really fit into the rest of the essay. I just stuck it in there because I wanted to tell the story. So Carl and I went to Russia. I was writing a piece for a magazine about my friend Renee Fleming, the opera singer. So we were traveling around Russia with Renee. And then Carl and I were flying back. We were flying out of Moscow. And there were so many babies in the airport, so many babies. I'd never seen so many babies. And then it turns out all the babies were on our plane. And it was this whole plane full of people who had come from the States to adopt babies in Russia. They do it all, I guess, as a group. So it was a plane full of babies for a 12-hour flight, which sounds like a terrible thing. But the babies were so happy and the parents were so happy. There were no crying babies. We had been standing next to this couple in line. And then when we got on the plane, they were seated in the row across from us. And at one point, the woman was up in the aisle walking her baby. Everybody was walking around. And she came back to the seat. Her husband was asleep and she was crying. She was on the aisle. Carl was on the aisle. And he asked her what was wrong. And the woman said, oh, a woman at the bathroom who had a baby, she told me there was something wrong with my baby. She said that my baby was neurologically impaired, that it couldn't hold its head upright, and that I should go to the doctor right away. And Carl said, you know, give me the baby. I'm a doctor. Give me the baby. So she hands him the baby, and he does these things, you know, that makes it look like he's examining the baby. He plays with the baby's finger, and he holds his finger in front of the baby's eyes. And he says, this is a perfect baby. I think this is the best baby on the plane, and I want to buy this baby. And I almost passed out. I thought they're going to throw us off the plane. He said, you know what? You can get another baby, but if you don't feel confident about this baby, then I'll buy this baby. I'll give you $20,000 for the baby. We'll arrange. I'll have my accountant wire you the money when we land. And I'm sitting there thinking, don't say this. This is horrifying. And the woman, of course, looks shocked because he's holding the baby. And then she says, you think this is a good baby? You think there's nothing wrong with this baby? You think this is a $20,000 baby?
Oh, God.
And she was completely stored. And he said, you know, here's my card. If you change your mind, I'll always buy this baby from you. And you can go back and adopt a different baby. It was the most outrageous thing in the world. But Carl is just someone who knows how people work. Like, he somehow knew that was what she needed to hear, that this was a valuable baby. And I said to him later, was there anything wrong with the baby? And he was like, there's nothing wrong with that baby. Oh. I always thought, what if she had said, yes, I do want to sell you the baby.
Well, you would never have been able to write the essay entitled, There Are No Children Here.
That's right. Because I would be raising a little Russian right now in my home.
you've described when you were 30, a male author whom you identify only by the initial Q, told you that to be a real writer, one must have children, or you will never know what it means to love. Please tell me who that was.
You know, I don't think that would be a great idea to tell you who it was. Because this is someone who when I was 30 and I'm 58 now, he had a very big career, which he no longer has a big career. I bet if I said his name, you wouldn't know it. And there were people in the audience that day who heard the whole exchange. There's no reason for me to give this guy a hard time. The point isn't who said it. The point is that people say the most outrageous things to women who don't have children, or to women who have too many children. The most interesting thing that came out of this essay is that a friend of mine sent it to his sister, and his sister has 7 children. And she said, I've never read anything that captured my experience like your essay about not having children, because everywhere she goes, people come up to her and say,
too many,
how could
children.
You have done this?
Yes.
You've had too many. It's too selfish. It's horrible of you. You're killing the planet. Why did you do this? You know, everyone has, the fact that people have opinions about women's reproductive choices, we think that's about birth control and abortion, but it actually is everything about women's reproductive choices that people feel the need to weigh in on. They are uncomfortable if you don't have children. They are uncomfortable if you have too many children. They think that their choice should be your choice.
And lambasting a woman with 7 children for destroying the planet is interesting, because you tell the story of a sister of a friend who had a baby. You admired her baby. She said, imagine how selfish a person would have to be to not have a child.
Yes.
So you can't.
What do you
win.
Do? What do you do? Know. Punch her in
what
the face?
You
know.
But as you quite rightly point out, nobody says to Jonathan Franzen, how can you be a writer? You haven't got any children.
Yes, that's right. There really is a different set of standards. And for me, this hasn't been a problem because I never wanted children, just not even for a second. I was born this way.
You did want Steve for a brief moment.
I did want Stevie, but that wasn't, as I said in this essay, that was really like seeing a child in a burning house and thinking, I've got to go get that kid out. It wasn't like, wow, I want to be a mother.
Just to clarify, it was an advertisement for fostering children or adopting children.
Yes.
And you think it was a bait and switch?
A bait and switch, because I did call about Stevie because they had a little profile in the newspaper. And he said, basically he was black. He was 8 years old. He said, all I want is a dog. I'll do my homework and I'll make my bed. If I could just get out of this orphanage, that's not wanting a child, but that is like, I'll go get that kid. I'll go get that kid.
There is an essay called, what is it called? Mm-hmm. It's about Charlie Strobel. What's that called?
Oh, yeah.
It's a Worthless Servant.
The Worthless Servant, yes.
And it illustrates this. You've written, the trouble with good fortune is that we tend to equate it with personal goodness, so that if things are going well for us and less well for others, it's assumed that they must have done something to have brought that misfortune on themselves, while we must have worked harder to avoid it. And I think you're right. I think that that's a sort of subconscious smugness that we have. But your essay is about a very, very good man, Charlie Strobel, who helped people who needed it, whose equally saintly mother was kidnapped and murdered by an escaped convict. And he continued to be what he described as, the Bible describes as, a worthless servant. Can you elaborate on that? Because how you put up with that kind of randomness in life seems to me to be important.
Yes. When Charlie's mother, Mary Catherine Strobel, was murdered, people in a gossipy way said, oh, she was murdered by one of the men at the homeless shelter, which absolutely wasn't true. It had nothing to do with the homeless shelter or with Charlie's work. But everybody tries to come up with a scenario so that they can say in their mind, well, this wouldn't happen to me. And people would say to Charlie, are you still going to do your work? And he would say, if it was worth doing before my mother was killed, it certainly would be worth doing after she was killed. The whole notion of a worthless servant is the idea that you serve other people so wholeheartedly that there is really nothing left of you. You are worthless. And what Charlie was saying is this was how Jesus served. And this is how my mother served and my aunt served when we were little. And this is how I want to serve. I want to just serve to the point where I basically disappear. And he says to me, wouldn't that be a wonderful thing to have on your tombstone? This was a worthless servant. And I said that, that is a very, very hard concept to grasp, but it is about the complete abolishment of ego, that you are just there to serve.
Good story. Good book.
Yeah. Good
very nice to talk to you.
And very nice to talk to you.
What are you writing now? What's your next book going to be? People are keen to know.
I'll tell you what I'm writing right now. I'm writing my name over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. I think I have signed somewhere between 25 and 30,000 copies of this book. And I have signed at least 5,000 in my own bookstore in the last 2 weeks. So when someone says, what are you writing? And I just think, I'm writing my name. That's it. I have an idea for a novel that is really all ready to go. And at the first of the year, when publicity is over, I will go back into my shell like a snail and pull the little hatch down, and I will write a novel.
Look forward to that. Anne Patchett, nice to talk to you. Anne Patchett is the author of the latest, her latest book is a collection called These Precious Days.